Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Can adverse experiences such as emotional neglect, abuse, perhaps witnessing domestic violence, maybe even diet and other environmental factors that occur very, very early in life predict behaviors and even health much later in life? Evidence is accumulating that this is indeed the case, and the mechanism to explain these lifelong effects are being found and studied. So why not listen in and perhaps participate with your questions and comments as Anchorage psychiatrist Dr. Mark Erickson and I discuss this fascinating new understanding of the brain, the mind, genetics, and health. Dr. Mark Erickson is a psychiatrist at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and he's director of telebehavioral medicine or health there. You can reach us during the next hour or so with your questions and comments. If you live in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1 in alaskapublic.org. Mark, it's a pleasure to meet you and have you as a guest.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start this by describing what has been called the ACE study, if you would maybe define that for our listeners and tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, the ACE study, ACE stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, and this was a large study that was carried out in the mid-90s, collaboration between the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente in San Diego. And the study was interested in two questions that had sort of haunted psychiatry for basically a century. And these questions were, is child abuse common? And is it harmful? Does it cause psychological harm, physical harm, and so forth? And I guess to begin, I'd like to just give a little historical context, which I think will allow the listeners to appreciate why so many of us regard this study as so important. So if you go back to 1896, Freud presented a paper called The Etiology of Hysteria. And in this paper, he argued that childhood abuse is common and that it causes a very substantial psychological harm over the course of the lifespan. Freud's paper was met with a stony silence, and he backed off from his views within a year and really said nothing about the issue the rest of his career. The question of child abuse and its prevalence basically occupied a backwater of psychiatry until the early 80s when, in part due to pressure from feminists such as Judith Herman and Diana Russell, three studies were published within 3 years, all of which showed that the prevalence of child abuse, and they're particularly focused on sexual abuse at the time, was far more common than anybody had imagined. This finding gave birth to a number of small studies which asked, is child abuse harmful? And the studies were typically narrowly focused. They would ask, you know, is sexual abuse in childhood associated with depression later in life? Yes. Is it associated with a risk for alcoholism later in life? Yes. So there's studies after studies were published, and this was a context in which Rob Anda and Vincent Folletti conceptualized the ACE study. And this occurred in the early 90s. Anda was involved in very large studies in CDC related to tobacco use and so forth. And so what he saw was that the studies on childhood adversity were too narrowly focused. So one question he brought up is, are childhood adversities aside from sexual abuse and physical abuse common? And are these other adversities also harmful? And so he introduced, so they decided in the study to look at 10 types of adversities, three types of three types of childhood abuse, physical, sexual, and psychological, two types of neglect, emotional and physical, and also whether there's domestic violence in home, mental illness, divorce, alcoholism, or if anybody had been sent to jail or prison. And they also wondered if the impact was broader than psychological, if it also included physical problems, such as heart disease and so forth. The third unique piece is that the size of the study was much larger than anything that came before, about 17,000 participants. And what they found was that childhood adversities were indeed extremely common. Almost two-thirds of the participants had at least one ACE, as they would call it. And that these ACEs were, all of them, risk factors for substantial health problems later in life, everything from suicide risk to heart disease. This study then gradually gained traction and is having a large impact on a lot of thinking now and about health.
You know, as I've become knowledgeable about this increasingly from a pediatrician standpoint, it's one of these studies that is just changing how everybody understands, how it gives an explanation for findings, and it gives us an opportunity to address these issues, which we can hopefully come back to and ask the question, if we can identify some risk factors, can we do anything about it? But let me, just for listeners again, to make sure they hear this, there's a large number of people through the Kaiser Permanente group, by two studiers. They were looking at the incidence of emotional abuse, neglect, and then what is called household dysfunction. Those are three categories, several questions in each one. And people answered yes or no to those questions. And then they looked at, over time, what happens to these individuals, their children, or themselves, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And what kind of health and mental health problems they had sustained, and then made a correlation between the frequency of these experiences that they had in childhood and their outcome.
That's right. Yeah, this was a retrospective study. So mm-hmm. the average age of a participant was about 57 years old.
Okay.
So they were, importantly, old enough to have a medical history. And because they were affiliated with Kaiser, they actually had the medical history. So they sent out this fairly lengthy questionnaire to all the participants and asked about these different early adversities, the three types of abuse that I mentioned, two types of neglect, and then the household circumstances. And what they found really actually stunned both Folletti and Anda. They really weren't expecting the prevalence rates. But and I should add that this was a middle class, relatively educated group.
Wasn't a handpicked high risk situation.
It wasn't handpicked or high risk. Only 8% didn't have a high school degree. Over 70% had some college education, and over 40% had a college degree. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, about 28% of this group tested positive for physical abuse during childhood, 21% sexual abuse, 11% emotional abuse, 15% emotional neglect, and I could go on. But suffice it to say that these adversities were not uncommon, and so because they had all this medical history, they could correlate the number of adversities with various illnesses, and they looked at an astonishing range, and they found that even one adversity often had an impact, for instance, on the risk for smoking or depression and so forth. In the end, they published, the first paper came out from this database in 1998. There have been probably about four dozen papers that have come out since, and they find that early adversities have this astonishing broad-based effect on health. Everything from lung disease and diabetes, heart disease, to things that you might expect, such as depression, anxiety disorders, alcohol, and drug dependence, and so forth.
So those people who filled out the questionnaire, they got 1 point if they said yes, no points if they had no, none. And I'm not sure how many total questions. It looks like to me it may be in 10. Is that or was there more than that?
There were seven initially in the first wave of the study, which was done in 1995, and the second wave in 1996, there were 10.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, with the seven, about 50% of that study group had at least one ACE, one adversity. When they bumped it up, when they added neglect, two neglect questions, it increased to almost two-thirds. And it turns out that neglect is a very significant risk factor for the various illnesses that they were, diseases and disorders they were looking at. So,
in the numbers I'm looking at in front of me, which is a kind of a review, the important points that jump out at me is 63% of the individuals in the study experienced at least one category. The categories are abuse, neglect, or household dysfunction. So 63%, and over 20%, one in five had three or more categories of trauma.
Yeah.
And the big ones, over 20% for each of these, experienced physical abuse, experienced sexual abuse, grew up with someone in the household using alcohol or drugs, are at least a parent with separation or divorce. So this was pretty common in a fairly non-biased group of individuals with pretty good education having health care.
The findings, we've now, I think, come to the point we realize that these adversities are common, but it might be worth noting that in medical textbooks written as recently as the late 1970s, the prevalence of child sexual abuse was placed at 1 in 1 million, and of child abuse in general at less than 1 in 2,000. So our ideas just a little over 30 years ago were so far off the mark that it's kind of astonishing. But we now know that early adversity is common and that it has a large impact on health. And
what if we look at it the other way around? What if we look at individuals who have obesity or have drug seeking or drug use behavior, have depression, suicide attempts? What do the ACE scores tell us about those things?
Probably the suicide data is the most striking of all. Children and adolescents with multiple childhood adversities can be as much as 50-fold or 5,000% greater risk for attempting suicide in childhood or adolescence. The numbers drop a little bit for adults, but it's still about 30-fold for multiple adversities. If you look diseases such as heart disease, for example, multiple childhood adversities, a high ACE score can increase the risk for heart disease by itself as much as being a heavy 3 or 4 pack per day smoker for decades. So it has a very large impact. And of course, these findings, they were so stunning that I think there are a lot of people that didn't know quite what to make of them at first and doubted them. I should add that the World Health Organization has carried out a 21-nation study with over 52,000 participants, so it was almost three times the size of the ACE study since the ACE study, and have found similar findings. So the question which emerged, and which I think we're going to get to before long, is what in the world is going on biologically? How is it that these early adversities can have such pervasive effects on health? And here, the answers that are coming out are just astonishing, and it's one of the most interesting examples of two areas of science coming together, one at a molecular level and the other one at an epidemiological level, that I've ever seen, that I've encountered basically in my career.
Dr. Erickson's discussing this idea of epigenetics, which we'll get to. I'm also very interested and excited by these findings and helping us understand disease and how we might modify disease. But before we get there, I want to ask a couple more questions about this study and the studies that are similar. But I also want to remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. We're originating from Anchorage, Alaska. If you've got questions or comments about the information that you're hearing today, or you have personal experiences that you'd like to share that may fit with this discussion, let me give you a couple of ways to call us or get in touch. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Mark, I'm always trying to stress the importance of science and how we really know what we know is probably true. And so we've discussed the idea of the importance of recreating or repeating or finding the same results. And you've already mentioned one of my points that I was going to ask is, have these studies been reproduced? And not only have they've been reproduced in multiple cultures and a larger number of people. So we can, although they're all retrospective, I suspect, I don't know all the studies, I don't know that we've been at it long enough, and there's some problems with retrospective studies with memory, and we've also talked about how memory is not perfect in humans. But it seems pretty reproducible. That makes it likely that much more likely that these are real findings.
Yes. Yeah. As mentioned, the World Health Organization has replicated the findings. In addition, there have been many small-scale studies, and I don't know of a single study that has found either no effect or benefits from a child abuse. I mean, virtually every study quite definitively finds an impact. The latest iteration of this way of thinking about health from an epidemiological point of view is happening in Scandinavia, where they have, because of the way their health system is designed, they can ask questions and include like 6 million participants, everybody born in Sweden and Denmark from 1979 to 2001. And so a question they're interested in is whether severe stress to a mother during pregnancy increases the risk, for instance, of asthma in the fetus, later child, and adult. Mm-hmm. Does it increase the risk for something like schizophrenia? And they're finding that the answer is yes, and that the effect is not small. 60% increased risk for schizophrenia based on severe stress early on.
So if I'm listening to our conversation and I'm putting myself out there in the listener's mind, I'm saying, you know, all right, so I hear this information that certain people have lots of experiences, lots of us have these experiences early in life, but I don't know that I've heard the idea that expressed as well yet, that this, what we're saying is, there's a high percentage of people later in life that have certain health problems, sexually transmitted disease, heart attacks, earlier chances of death, more likely to be drug abusers, more likely to have suicide, more likely to have depression. And what we're saying is that these experiences, perhaps in the first couple of years of life, maybe even while in utero, can predict these later experiences 50 years, 60 years later. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah, and it is stunning. And as some of the listeners here know, both Rob and Vincent Folletti have spoken in Anchorage. And several months ago, Robert Anda was in town, and after his talk, I went up to him and I asked whether the ACEs, the consciously recollected traumas that the participants in the ACE study remembered, I mean, presumably they were things that happened after the age of six or thereabouts, whether they were the real driver of the health problems, the health risks, or were they a flag, a marker for something that was happening earlier in life.
Right.
And Anda thought about it for a moment, and he said, you know, I think there, it's probably a marker for stressful events early in life when development was happening at a greater pace. Mm-hmm. And that's a question now that there is great interest in research.
You know, and that brings a question to my mind that I'd like one some clarification on, but also brings the needle back to what's the mechanism. Is it's my understanding that the evidence is that humans have very poor recall that is accurate for information prior. I think three years of age. You implied maybe six and something you said a minute ago. So if that's true, then we can't blame our memories for what the consequences are. There must be some other mechanism going on.
Well, that's a very good and I think a really important point. There, in memory research, there's a sort of distinction made between explicit memory, memories of, you know, what your phone number is and what happened when you were on mm-hmm. your seventh birthday and so forth, mm-hmm. and implicit memories, which is sort of feeling-based. What did it feel like when you were 1 year old or 2 years old? And that feeling, in a sense, was the language and the memory of that time in life. So what the epigenetic research suggests, and I know we'll get to that.
Yep, we'll define that. But hopefully,
but it suggests that these early stressful experiences, even though not consciously recollected,
right,
nevertheless leave a rather striking mark on the epigenome.
Okay, Carolyn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, hi. I understand you're going to be asking a question having to do with populations and so forth. I was wondering a couple of things, whether or not there are cultural attitudes. I mean, are the Italians more friendly than the Germans, you know, toward their children? I remember hearing some years ago that the Plains Indians made reference to the people coming across as the people who beat their children.
Right. Right.
And you know, I lived in Samoa many years ago, and the children were totally loved. It was only when they got up to be about three or four that older brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles would whop them if they got out of place. But they were just completely loved. They were held by everybody. I mean, it was just an amazing thing for me to see based upon where I came from. So I'm right. just wondering if some of the places like in New Guinea or wherever, where there's a small population base, does that have any impact? And you know, is it in any way cultural or geographical? Geographic.
Okay. Thanks Alrighty. For your call.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Yeah. A very good question. There's a lot of interest in anthropology in that question. And certainly there are cultures that are much more, you might say, indulgent or attentive to children. I think that the big question that biologists that think about this a lot, and anthropologists and so forth, wonder about is whether our modern world, which is so incredibly different from, I mean, I think probably most of the listeners, if they could just go back two or three generations, they would find that their relatives lived maybe in a rural area, that there was extended family nearby. For the first time in the history of our species, we have children that are being raised away from extended families or even families, and so that increases the risk for things like neglect and so forth. But the question is a wonderful one, is a really important one question. To what extent is perhaps modern culture disrupting quality parenting, which appears to be the foundation for health across the lifespan.
But it's your understanding that, at least per other studies, including the World Health Organization, as of this point, clear cultural differences have not been significant?
I'm
Doesn't
not
mean they're not, but we just haven't seen that yet?
I'm not aware of studies that have examined that carefully.
Okay. All right. So we've made, all right.
Yeah. The World Health Organization studies, I believe, are held mainly in sort of urban areas. And there are different, many different countries, but But there's not a good comparison made between.
So we may have done it in Sweden, but we haven't compared it with the U.S.,
yes,
for
yeah.
example.
Yeah.
Okay, so we don't perhaps know that answer.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email, line1@alaskapublic.org. It's time for our halftime break, and after this short break, we'll continue our discussion on the long-term effects of early adverse childhood experiences with Anchorage psychiatrist Dr. Mark Erickson. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Mark Erickson. Dr. Erickson is a psychiatrist at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and we're discussing long-term, what appears to be lifelong effects of adverse childhood experiences, emotional neglect, abuse, perhaps witnessing domestic violence, being in a home where there's drug abuse, or even a divorce and separation. And the long-term effects of these experiences on children. And we are about to begin a discussion of one or two, perhaps, mechanisms by which these effects might work. You can email questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday night, you're listening to a taped recording, we will not be available to answer your calls or emails. So, Dr. Erickson, we've got this information that suggests that very early in life, things can happen to us that fairly accurately predict later mental health issues and even later physical health issues. And as you implied, at the same time, there's been some rather interesting new information coming out of our studies of our human genome that seem to provide a mechanism for this to happen. Would you help us understand that?
I'll give this a go. I'm going to start discussing the field of epigenetics, and I could add that in college I was a biology degree and as a biology major, and the biology of epigenetics is really the most complex I've ever encountered. It's but nevertheless fascinating. So, in a general way, epigenetics can be thought of as how genes are regulated. And so our body contains about 10 trillion cells, excuse me. Each one has the same genome, the same 23,000 genes. And on each one of these genes, there is a way to turn it on and turn it off. And the study of epigenetics is essentially how genes are regulated, how they're turned on and turned off. And one might imagine it as epigenetic mechanisms as being sort of a rheostat for a gene. It's worth sort of pointing out that in each cell in our body, about 70 to 80% of the genes are actually turned off. They're not used, and only about 20% are needed. One of the best ways to think about epigenetics and how the field originally developed was just to think of your body, and as you sort of contemplate your body, You notice you've got skin cells and you've got muscle cells and you have neurons and you have cells that compose your bones, and they're all quite different. So how did the same genome create all this diversity? And in the 80s, they started to notice these chemical marks on genes. And someone, a few people imagined, well, maybe these marks have some purpose. And it turns out the marks helped regulate, and the marks have to be in a certain area, in the regulatory part of a gene, but they regulate gene activity. And for the first 20 years of the field of epigenetics, everyone thought that was pretty much the whole story, that what happened epigenetically happened inside the womb, if you will, and had very little, there's really no environmental effect. But more recently, within the last 10 or 15 years, we've learned that the epigenome is indeed influenced by the environment, and that this is probably what is causing the impact, the effects that translate into long-term risk from ACEs for various health problems.
So our genes can't change fast enough. Something else has to allow us to respond to the environment. It's another way to think about what you're saying, what we recognize now.
That's right. Yes, the historically the dogma, which I suspect both of us learned in medical school, and basically arose in following Watson and Crick in 1953, once they described the double helical structure of DNA, is that DNA, the hard drive, is translated to RNA, and that's translated to protein, and that's what makes the body. So you've got this one unidirectional sort of flow of information from the gene to the protein in the body. But what's been discovered recently is that there's this whole other system that regulates the genome called the epigenome. And even more recently, that the epigenome is influenced by the environment. There have been, just to give you an idea of how where these studies are going, very recently there have been two studies just looking at the effect of rural versus urban life, and they find significant epigenetic effects just depending on whether you live in a rural area or an urban area.
The classic study that I remember got me thinking about this, and I think got lots of people interested, was what you can do to mice that you can't do to humans ethically, and that's you can raise perfectly identical mice. Mm-hmm. You can keep them in exactly the same environment. You can do, so everything is controlled. And yet you can take two female mice and feed them differently. Everything else is controlled, and the color of the hair, the pelts of their offspring, can be controlled or manipulated by diet alone. And their genes are exactly the same. That's easy to determine.
Yeah. Yeah, that study, so that was the first what might be called environmental epigenetic study, was published just 11 years ago by Randy Jertle and his team. I believe they're at Duke. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it was just as you described, that the diet could change not only the coat color, but the mice that became yellow versus gray, gained a lot of weight. There's just striking differences, and the only difference at all was just what the mother was fed. It's a stunning finding.
Yeah. And you're right. You've reminded me. And not only did those yellow mice, the one group that was fed not as nutritiously as I recall as the other, got heavier, had an increased risk of diabetes, died earlier because those mice have normal lifespans that are much quicker than us. And incidentally, they got almost exactly all the same genetic material we have. We're talking about individuals. People don't understand this, I don't think, still. That's why we can study mice and make such pretty close guesses at what's happening in humans. They have the same genes. They're doing the same kinds of things.
Hmm. Yeah. So just I certainly agree with your comment. The whole story of the ACE study and epigenetics happened with a simple and elegant study that was published in 1999 by Darlene Francis, who is at that point was at McGill University, and she's now at Berkeley. And what she noticed was that in lab mice, again, these are genetically identical mice, that there was a sort of a bell curve in terms of maternal care. And so some mice mothers would give high levels of care to their offspring, litter after litter after litter, and their offspring would in turn become high care parents. At the other end of the curve, there were low care mothers who would give birth to pups that in turn became low care parents. And it all looked very hardwired, like this is written in the genome. But she did this remarkable piece of the study. She would take about three pups out of each litter shortly after birth and transfer them from a high care mother to a low care mother. And those pups would, their behavior, their parental behavior would mirror not their biological mother, but their adoptive mother. So adopted low care pups became low care parents, and adopted pups from a low care mother adopted to a high care mother became high care parents. This suggested that it wasn't genetic, and this lab was well ahead of the curve, and they were already thinking about epigenetics as a possible explanation. So in 2004, in the same lab, a researcher named Ian Weaver showed that, and he was looking at one gene out of the entire genome, the gene for the glucocorticoid receptor gene, which is tied into the stress response. He predicted that low levels of care would epigenetically alter the expression of this gene, and that's exactly what he found. And so this was the first study to trace a social experience to a change in gene expression. And Weaver's study has been cited now over 2,800 times. It's had been hugely influential.
What would be the consequences, for example, let's say in humans, of upregulating the cortisol receptor?
So that's what Weaver was interested in, and in their studies, what he found was he was looking at the expression of the glucocorticoid receptor in a part of the brain that acted as a brake to the stress response, and pups that had low levels of care had fewer glucocorticoid receptors. And as a consequence, had less of a break to their stress response, so that when they were stressed, their stress response would continue much longer than it would for pups with high levels of care. It's not hard to imagine how that would increase the risk
appears to be explained because of the early stress response changing the biology of the stress response through epigenetic mechanisms.
Right. The low levels of care,
right.
The low levels of care were presumably experienced by the rat pups as stressful. That actually altered the expression of this gene, the glucocorticoid receptor gene, in this case, downregulating expression in certain part of the brain. And so with Weaver's study, there naturally was interest in whether does something like this happen in humans? And again, from the same lab at McGill University, they've really been pioneers in this area, Patrick McGowan in 2009 replicated Weaver's study in humans. And what they actually did was compare, they were able to get cadaver tissue from 12 humans that had died of suicide and had a known history of child abuse. 12 adults that had died of suicide without such a history, and 12 adults that had died abruptly from other causes. And they found essentially the same sort of difference in expression of the glucocorticoid receptor gene based on the early experience. So that the study was essentially replicated in humans, and it's mm-hmm. been subsequently replicated in different ways mm-hmm. in humans.
And I want to point out, just to broaden the understanding of this, which has happened very quickly, that it's clear that many multiple complex illnesses in humans, allergy, autoimmune diseases, that epigenetic changes, probably early in life, may be important factors. Now it is so easy to tell which genes are turned on. Another study that I recall was taking people in Algeria, and depending on whether they lived in the city, whether they lived in the country, or whether they really were Bedouins moving around all over the place, the same genes in closely related people were turned on at different times depending on where you live. So you could tell from where you live, what your environment was, that different genes in the lung, which was this asthma study, were turned on. So it's very clear that environmental effects, you've been mentioning social stressors, but we haven't mentioned, I mentioned maybe earlier, diet in animals certainly does, and it certainly can affect, we think, the risk of allergy. And now we're looking at this thing called the microbiome, what everything that's in our intestinal tract and how it's affecting things. So this is really not only fascinating, but has gotten so complex that it is unfathomable to me right now how we're going to figure it all out. We have a tendency to think linearly. You do this, then this, then this, then this. But we're not just a mouse or a rat sitting in a place where nothing but the diet has been changed. We've got temperature changes. We've got stressors. We're driving cars. We're exposed to different foods. We're living in houses that have off gases of organic materials. Sure. So it's a much, much, much more complex issue than might appear.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is. As you know, I mean, if you spend some time sort of jumping into this literature, the stories are moving so rapidly, and that you feel there is a paradigm shift going on here.
Right.
But the dust hasn't even come close to being settled.
Right.
We just don't know what it's going to look like on the other end. And I might add the epigenetic effects are. As you mentioned, it's all sorts of things can cause them, but one of the questions about and getting back to the ACE study is, do childhood adversities affect more than the glucocorticoid receptor gene?
Sure.
And everybody imagined that the effect would be broader than just one gene out of 23,000. And so just basically in the last year, 2013, Joan Kaufman, who's in the psychiatry department at Yale, published a study in which they compared 96 children who had a history of abuse, verified abuse taken from their homes, to 96 children without such an abuse history. And they were able to look across almost the entire genome for a particular type of epigenetic mark. And she found, their group found over 2,800 sites where there was epigenetic difference between the maltreated group and the non-maltreated group. And these sites traced back to genes that were linked to everything from brain development to cancer risk and so forth. So this was a study that sort of for the first time brought the ACE data. It provided a molecular level foundation, and it really is striking. The second study that basically replicated Kaufman's work was published just 3 months ago by Matthew Suderman, who again is from the McGill University group, and similar findings. In this case, the subject group was 45 years of age, so they were seeing these epigenetic marks that had persisted. The first group was in childhood, but the second group was decades older, and you're still seeing the epigenetic marks.
I could keep talking about this for a while, but I do have a couple of emails and a phone call, and I want to take those if we can. Mary, you're on line one?
Yes, hi. I have an elderly mother who died recently who was narcissistic, had a histrionic personality, hypochondria, depression, pressured speech, and toxic personality. And a nurse practitioner had suggested that this could be the result of abuse as a child, that some of these personality disorders could have resulted from that. And so I've never investigated it very much. We never had mom go to therapy. She had dementia, and anyway, we never got it diagnosed.
That pattern certainly is suggestive. I mean, of course, there are people that have perfectly normal childhoods and then go on and maybe don't do well. But the ACE study as a whole would suggest that that pattern certainly is indicative of you know that your grandmother may have experienced significant adversity early on.
Mm-hmm. Because she would talk about her idyllic childhood, and so and my brother and I are just kind of curious.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to try to trace that out because one of the ACE studies actually looked at autobiographical memory and history of early adversity is associated with struggles with memory and a lot of times people don't give a very accurate history until it's really explored. It's also possible that your grandmother did have an idyllic childhood and
yeah.
So we don't know.
We'd hope so, but okay. Yeah, it could explain some things. But well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
One of our emails said, "Isn't it only the past 150 years or so that we think of childhood as really existed? Previously, so many children died, and who didn't were expected to contribute." And that's one of the whole points about the epigenetics is really in the last 150 years. The population of the world has exploded from less than a billion to 7 billion. The Industrial Revolution happened in the 1800s. There have been such sudden, such rapid, such dramatic changes in the environment that the environment alone cannot explain, our genes alone cannot explain all the changes. So it has to be the environment, which is one of the reasons why this has piqued so many people's interest, is this whole epigenetic mechanism has become clear.
Yeah, it's I agree. There's the changes that have occurred have been very dramatic. I think it's worth pointing out that in anthropological studies of intact cultures, traditional cultures, that children typically had multiple caregivers. The duration of breastfeeding was in the range of 3 to 5 years. There were long intervals between births. There's good reason to believe there was a high level of responsivity of care in the early years of life. And by early, I mean maybe the first 5-6 years of life. Things might have gotten much tougher after that, but that there are a lot of academics who think that was typical of life long ago, and that certainly isn't the case now. That
there are a number of parallel or coincidental ideas with health that are formulating at this point. I can think of two really quickly. One is if you go online and you look up the first 1,000 days in the early pediatric experience, that from pregnancy, that first 9 months through the first 2 years of life, is being espoused as extremely critical, not only because of the experiences that you've talked about, but diet, what kids are doing, all those kinds of things, and they are having lifelong impacts. And then there's a theory called the developmental origins of disease, which takes all this even deeper. It says, to a large degree, unbelievable degree, things that happened to us at 50, 60, 70 years were almost, I'm careful here, preordained, but set up by experiences in the first several years of life, for sure. And this all begins to make some sense if you understand how biology is working.
It does, and I mean, we're talking about the dust settling. The developmental origins of health and disease is maybe a label that might persist and sort of encapsulate the paradigm we've been talking about. It's something that you see more in the literature. Just to add one piece to that, there's a growing research on the epigenetics of the placenta. And the placenta is sort of like this way station between what's going on, the level of the stress that the mother is experiencing and the fetus. And there's all this messaging that's going on between the three. And that messaging impacts, it basically is sending, the placenta sort of translating this message to the fetus about whether the world, whether the weather report looks good, whether the world looks like it's going to be a good supportive place, or if it's going to be rough. And if it looks like that message, if you will, can actually affect the expression of literally hundreds of genes.
So we got a little over 5 minutes left, and one of my other emails is a good way to kind of work towards the end. It says, as a parent, what can we do to help children who've gone through these adversities and traumas early in their lives? And let me broaden the question a little bit more. Now that we are beginning to understand how early experiences can be biologically translated into later experiences, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can effectively have interventions. It's a long way between that. Let's assume that it's all correct and there's no other good explanation, which there's always that possibility. But just getting people to a therapist now may not change those epigenetic changes or changes to the structure of our cortisol receptor in pregnancy may not be amenable to changes later, or even if you could change them, the developmental changes have already occurred that you can't reverse.
Yeah, it's they're already. I mean, the question you're raising is of course, getting a lot of attention, and they're actually just in the last year there have been three studies that have two of them have looked at psychotherapy, and one of them looked at meditation and whether they could conceivably reverse any epigenetic effects. And there's some preliminary evidence that suggests maybe. But I think that the big message from the epigenetic story is that it probably pays us enormous dividends if we invest early, in early life care. Sweden, for instance, spends more money in the first year of life than any other year. The epigenetic work suggests that we should as you mentioned, that the first 1,000 days we should be investing very heavily. And there's a whole, this is another discussion, but there's a whole group of economists that are looking at this very question. You know, how do we get the biggest return for our investment? And the data suggests clearly that early investment in high quality early care is the way to go.
We have got a couple minutes, and one, I always like to finish with what do we want people to remember? But before we do that, we have not quite given another implication of this, and that is the transgenerational changes, that changes that happen in a mother now might affect her grandchildren.
That's exactly right. And it's one of the more frightening things about the epigenetic literature, but at the same time, it's one of the more hopeful observations because it suggests that if we're mindful as a society and really attend to early life, that these generational patterns can be, that we're seeing in the mice, for example, can be reversed. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is easy at all, but I do think it's doable. And I mean, my own view is that we clearly should invest.
The epidemiologist in me has just come up with another question. And again, I was trying to think positively about these ACE study. So it showed 62% of people had at least one of these experiences that we are calling somewhat high risk. That means 38% did not. One in three. What would be interesting to know, and maybe you know this has been done, what percentage of those people went ahead to have poor health, poor psychological health, suicide, depression, and so forth. It's always important to look at the those who do not have the risk factors to see where they fit.
Yeah, the ACE study, one of the things that Rob and recognized is that you really needed large numbers to get good data. And so all the ACE study says is that early adversity increases the risk, the probability of having these health problems. And low ACE and having no ACEs decreases the risk.
Yep,
it doesn't eliminate
right.
the risk. It just right. decreases it. So.
Right. So there was that exposure kind of thing, which we often see with related things. The higher the exposure, the more likely the risks.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So we're in our last couple of minutes. What do you want listeners to take away from this? What do you want them to remember? What do you want them to do differently?
What we've learned, and it's really been in a strikingly brief period of time, essentially the last decade, is that, or last 15 years, is that a whole array of adversities early in life, it's worth noting that the ACE study expanded it to 10, but I think if Rob Anda and Vincent Folletti were in this office today, they would say they're more than 10. We need to understand what early adversity does to health. And as a society, we need to think about this very carefully and, you know, ask ourselves what kind of world do we want for our children, for our grandchildren, and so forth. And if we want a world of healthier, more pro-social, capable people, the answer is pretty clear that we need to invest more heavily in early life care. And I would add a plug here for support for mothers during pregnancy, for maternity leave, and so forth, which our policy in this country is not nearly as good as it is elsewhere.
Yeah, I like throwing a plug for trying to educate the public about what's going on out there.
Yeah.
So. Thanks, Mark, very much. It's just been a pleasure to meet you and discuss this. I hope listeners are appreciating the importance of this kind of discussion.
Thanks, Dad. My pleasure.
All right. Next week, we'll be back, and Prentice Pemberton's going to be the host. And he's going to be talking with a psychologist, Dr. Ron Olson. They're going to be talking about nicotine addiction. It seems that a very, very high percentage of people who use nicotine get hooked for a long time, and they have very long consequences, including death sometimes. So if you want to learn more, join him July 21st at 2 p.m., repeating at 9 p.m. I also want to remind everybody that Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and helped engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.